Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
On the show this week, it is the happiest time of the year and probably my favourite episode. We're going to be doing all killer and no filler, counting down the best movies of 2023. So, just to get things started, like people that are, you know, following the magazine will know that there is a list officially out there talking about what the official Little White Lies picks are for the best films of 2023. But, you know, not to be too negative, how do you guys feel about the worst of lists that some people put out?
Having accidentally started a Twitter discourse about this once this week, I'm loath to say anything. But I don't know. I think it. I'm not 100% opposed, but I think there has to be like proper rationale to it. I don't think it's useful to just put a list out there ragging on films that you didn't like. Now that makes me sound like I don't like them at all. I don't know. It's context, isn't it? I think it's reverse shot in their like end of the year thing. They do like a sins of the year thing where they pick out like one very specific thing from a film or like a moment that they like really, really hated. And that I love. But yeah, just to me, like putting out a list of like, I didn't like these films just feels a bit like unproductive. Like what am I supposed to do with that? Congrats on being a hater.
My take is that I think if we're doing best of lists, then there has to be worst of lists. That has to be allowed. If we're allowed to say what we love, then we're allowed to say what we hate, because those two emotions do not kind of cancel each other out. But I do agree. I think that there are ways to do it in a constructive and nuanced way, because, you know, we spend the year on this podcast and on our website, you know, we see films that we kind of argue the case against. So that material is already out there for people to see. And all a worst of the year list will be doing is collecting it all together and, you know, in a single package. You know, I understand there are a lot of people who dislike it for reasons of like, it's kind of offensive to the filmmakers who put so much effort into making their films. But, you know, like every film takes a lot of time and effort to make, and some of them work and some of them don't. And, you know, this is what we are and what we do. So, I mean, you know, but I think by denying that would be denying it the very raison d'etre of journalism and criticism. So, you know, that's my reason for.
Well, I guess my issue with it is more that I feel like they're never terribly well informed, because if there's some like incredible gem that comes out of here, like, you know, you hear about some, you know, tiny little film, you know, that's, you know, absolutely incredible, you go out of your way to seek it out. And basically, unless I'm being paid or hired to go and see something, I'm not going to go watch Jurassic Park Dominion or, you know, some janky little horror film that's like absolute rubbish, or quite frankly thought Skinamarink was really overrated. So I actually think that I'm sort of self-editing. So like whatever I think is going to be my worst films of the year is going to be pretty poorly informed.
I think that often the problem is with worst of lists, it's just someone saying, I didn't like this, and if you liked it, then you're an idiot. That's like the tone of all these like worst of lists. And it's like, okay, I'm not sitting there as a fan of films and saying, if you don't like it, then you know, you're invalid. I really, if I like a film and someone dislikes it, it's either cause for a kind of fun debate about that, or it's just like, great, all the more for me. Like, you know, it doesn't impact my life in any way, unless they're kind of being, you know, really obnoxious about it. And I'm sure people feel that way, you know, when I tweet about not liking a film. I remember, I think probably one of my least favourite watches of the year was Bottoms. And I tweeted about not liking Bottoms. And I'd written a review and people got really angry with me about it. And it's like, I'm allowed to have that opinion. I guess it's just like everything. It's kind of how you disperse that information, isn't it? Some of them can be very funny. When I read a list that is like pure hatred and it's written in quite a funny way, then I'm like, oh yeah, okay, this is funny. Even when I like the films. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I do always think that there's kind of a misconception with this role that it's more like combative than it is. Like I have like my brother or like certain friends that will be like, oh, I really didn't like that film that you liked, or vice versa. And I will be like, sure.
That's nice for you.
Yeah. Very, very, very odd, where it's like, I feel like people expect me to be Ridley Scott defending Napoleon.
Yeah, I think Hannah's completely right. I mean, it is about context. And I think you're right too. Like, if we're going to be very strict about these things, you know, if you're going to do a worst of the year list, you have to do the work. You have to try and see as much as possible and have the broadest possible canvas.
It is an issue with like the entire industry, but it's kind of a bit the clickbaitification of film criticism, where it's like, it feels inevitable that people will publish a worst of list and they'll put something that's really good on it just to be discoursey.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's absolutely fine. And to be honest, I think that we shouldn't really be policing what people hate as long as they are able to kind of, you know, justify it in some way. Yeah, what Hannah says is true. I think that, like, I wouldn't mind a little bit more kind of, I understand you like this, but actually, for me, it didn't work, rather than, this is bad, and if you like it, you're evil and stupid, which is sometimes the implication in these things. But I'm happy for people who want to do these, if they want to do them properly. Like, there's a critic, Mike McCahill, who... he's been on the pod before, and he writes for Little White Lies, and he writes reviews for The Guardian, and he kind of makes a point of he sees pretty much everything that comes out, and he reviews it, you know, sometimes for The Guardian, sometimes just capsules for his own website. So he is someone who, if he did a worst of the year list, I would trust him, because he is someone who has, you know, seen the majority of releases of the year, and actually will be able to sort of survey that landscape with some measure of expertise. Whereas, yeah, there are people who, you know, will dive into a couple of festivals and see some small films that didn't work for them, and just by dint of the fact that they haven't watched very much, those will end up being on their worst of the year list. So
yeah. Do you have kind of like any ethics about like a real panning review? I mean, that's not necessarily like connected to worst of the year, but like, personally, I try to never hold a film's like cheapness against it. That feels unfair to me, but like, do you have something of like a system where you're just like, oh, I'm not going to like really go in on this for any particular reason?
Yeah. I think that as an editor, I'm sort of very, very conscious of this kind of stuff. And, you know, if I feel that like part of being a critic is being able to discern that, about knowing which films deserve which treatment. Like, you know, if I think of original earnest intent that is maybe quite small scale, and you watch it and it just doesn't work at all for you, or you have some sort of like deep criticisms of it, I think that you have to judge the tone with which that you kind of articulate that. Whereas if it's, you know, if it is a huge big blockbuster film that the studios have maybe been sort of hiding away and haven't preview screened, and artistry, originality, and the things that you value are obviously secondary to this enterprise, then, you know, that's when you can go in studs up a bit and have a play. Like, I felt justified to sort of write quite a negative review of the new Hunger Games film, because for me that felt like a franchise cash in where there was an attempt to make to sort of reignite a sort of dormant franchise, and the actual kind of film itself felt like an afterthought. So, like, that for me was something that felt justified.
Well, I mean, also with that, in the case of that one, just sitting next to you and watching, I could kind of feel you physically
that
like
was
deflate
a horrible, horrible
when you
feeling.
Realized there was another hour to go, despite it having had quite a clear ending. Any really negative reviews this year that you feel very justified in having written?
I think I justified my Bottoms review and my Cat Person review. I'm trying to remember what else.
Oh my god, Cat Person.
Yeah, terrible. Ooh. Film. Really quite awful. And again, like, that's an indie film. You never want to, like, especially with independent films, you don't want to kind of go in there and start, like, shooting. Because it is, you know, they struggle. Like, Lionsgate will be fine if someone dislikes The Hunger Games. That's totally fine. You know, they've got millions and millions of dollars to keep them warm at night. But yeah, with indie films, you know, it can massively affect not only the kind of that film, but, you know, the kind of the director and the actors, like, going forward. But at the same time, if I think a film is genuinely, like, very bad, and particularly with regards to, like, subject matter and the way things are handled, I think, yeah, there is a kind of duty to write about that and do it in a way that is, you know, kind of clear-eyed, which can be difficult when you're really angry at a film. Like, I remember watching Cat Person, just being so angry. I was like, what a waste of my time this is. There's no feeling worse as a critic than, like, I've had my time wasted by a film. Sometimes you watch a bad film and you're like, well, I'm still kind of glad I saw it, even though it wasn't very good. But yeah, I mean, it is difficult. I mean, I think David and I always say this, like, kind of younger critics that are coming in to do work with us, it is so much harder, I think, to write, like, a well-written bad review. Like, you know, especially for someone like Little White Lies, where I think we do want to engage with what we're watching. We're not just kind of writing a pan for the sake of writing a pan. Indeed, we have written good reviews of big, silly blockbuster films before. So, you know, I think there's maybe a misconception that
David defended The Eternals.
He did, yeah, very hard, yeah.
And I probably actually wrote one of the nicer reviews of The Flash as well, considering how badly that got pilloried. So, you know, it's just all about being honest in the end, trying to sort of justify what you're saying rather than going on a, you know, invective-strewn polemic that's highly subjective and doesn't justify your argument. That's it. That applies to pro and con, I think.
Yeah, fully agreed. I mean, and despite what many of our colleagues complain about on Twitter, that's why I do love the embargo system in a way, that, like, a lot of the times you do have to form your thoughts in a bubble, and then we all at once discover what everyone else thought, and there isn't too much, like, groupthink, I think, under that system.
I think that's part of the fun of it, is, like, you know, when the embargo lifts, and especially if it's a film that is quite divisive, you know, you immediately have that thing of, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe XYZ said XYZ about it. You know, I think it's really fun.
I love the Saw X one lifting and everyone being like, good, actually. And I believe that was the first Saw that they'd ever screened to critics. And yes, speaking to the PRs, they were as surprised as anyone. But we should get on to some of the actual best films of the year.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
David, I believe your first choice is Earth Mama, something that just recently did quite well at the Biffers. So, you know, You're on with a good group of people that have decided this is a special film.
Yeah, we didn't get to cover it in the show because it was, I think it was a sort of big week that week. This is something I encountered, and it was a weird one because I'd watched it on a, I think I had like a day where I watched like four films on screeners. because I was doing a bit of a kind of screener catch up, and this was one of them, and it really kind of instantly stood out as being kind of, you know, something a little bit more premium and interesting than the other films I'd watched. And it's a first time filmmaker called Savannah Leaf, who has a very interesting backstory. She was born in the UK and moved to the US when she was young, and she actually someone who represented the UK at the Olympics. She represented Team GB in the 2012 Olympics in volleyball, and has now pivoted to becoming a really fantastic and intuitive filmmaker. And Earth Mama is a film, it's a film I think whose subject matter has been, you know, is fairly kind of time-worn, in that it is about a story about a woman who's had two of her young children taken away from her by social services, and she is essentially kind of fighting against the system to try and get them back. And at the same time, she's also pregnant with another child. So she's in. So it's this very sort of strange push and pull of having to deal with her own well-being, while also, you know, trying to sort of get her children back. And the film doesn't sentimentalize this in any way. And it's very, very objective in how it kind of presents this character, and how maybe that she's had her children taken away for good reason, but maybe the system that has done this is not fit for purpose. But maybe the people who are involved in working this system, like the bureaucrats and the people who she has to interface with, are actually good people and want to help her, but whose hands are tied for other reasons. And it's really a kind of very small, intimate social realist film that speaks it's angry and it's melancholy, but in a very beautiful, articulate way, very, very moving way. You know, and it's not done in your kind of standard issue, shaky handheld camera style. It's done in a more sort of ethereal and slow moving style, and it captures a lot of the kind of in the moment emotions. And, you know, it's a film where you kind of love this character, despite the flaws and the fact that she's very, you know, she can't, you know, she finds it tough to deal with this very awful situation, understandably so, and kind of has these kind of flame outs, and, you know, her friends are trying to help her, and she can't really decide whether that's a good or bad thing. And, you know, I think she sees herself as being kind of alone in this situation. But yeah, no, it's a really, really strong film, and it's on our top 30 of the year. And we, can't wait to see what Savannah Leaf does next. If she can one up this, would be a massive achievement.
Lady Bird. Does it feel kind of like it might be referencing that film?
Well, that's interesting. I've not seen Lady Bird, but that's interesting you mention it, because Ken Loach is actually a reference point that I thought of while watching the film, because he has been so interested recently in making these films about people encountering this corrupt system and sometimes, you know, dying as a result of its inefficiencies. And, you know, there is a Ken Loach element at the core of this film about, you know, a lone, disenfranchised young black woman who is trying to like make this system work for her, and finding it, you know, at every turn there are just more things in her way. So yeah, no, I haven't. I will catch up with Lady Bird on your recommendation if you think that there's a crossover there. But, you know, totally right on the Ken Loach thing.
We'll do a switcheroo. I will watch Earth Mama. You will watch Lady Bird, and we will reconvene. Hannah, your first pick of the year, I believe, is Showing Up.
Yeah, technically a 2022 film, I guess, but it never came out here in 2022, and technically it hasn't come out in 2023 either in the UK. It did come out in America. It came out in April of this year in the States, and I guess it's getting a DVD release now in the UK in January, according to the internet, from what we can tell. But yeah, this is Kelly Reichardt's latest film. Obviously, A Little White Lies, we're big fans of hers. We did the first Cow issue. And then for whatever reason, Showing Up just didn't come out. We heard a lot of rumours about it getting a release and it being picked up for distribution, but yeah, who knows? Who knows what happened? But this is a film, it's the fourth collaboration with Michelle Williams, who is kind of Kelly Reichardt's muse and reportedly helped her finance one of her films with her paycheck from Venom, which is still just like such a great story. And it is about a sculptor who is preparing for an art show that she has while kind of balancing her family commitments, her job at a local art college, and various home troubles, shall we say, literally, in that her shower, her hot water isn't working, and her landlady, who lives downstairs and is also her friend and fellow artist, played really wonderfully by Hong Chau, is refusing to do anything about it, in a kind of nice, like, very like, oh yeah, I'll get around to it way. And her pet cat has also injured a local pigeon that poor Lizzie, the artist, then finds herself roped into rehabilitating. So it's a very funny, very kind of gentle film about being a freelancer, basically, and the problems of trying to make art under capitalism, which I think lots of people listening to this, and I'm sure you guys as well can relate to, and that push and pull of how can I find space for myself in a world that does not kind of accommodate that sort of freedom. And yeah, I just loved it. It's a film I've thought about kind of constantly since I saw it, and I feel like it's been done a little bit dirty in the UK with it. Well, a lot dirty in the UK, because I think it should have got a wide release, and it should have been seen by more people, because it's just really special and sweet. And like all of Kelly Reichardt's films, I think she operates in this mode that I find so enjoyable, even when, you know, some of her kind of older films, I think I'm not kind of as quite crazy about them as a lot of people are, like Old Joy and even like Certain Women. Yeah, I'm a little bit more like lukewarm on them than other people. But this one, yeah, I think it might actually be my favorite of her films to date. I just really, there's so much to love in it. I think Michelle Williams is giving this very unshowy, unglamorous performance. She's quite curmudgeonly as Lizzie. And then you have this incredible supporting cast, which, as I mentioned, Hong Chau is incredible. But then you've got John McGarrow playing her like wayward little brother, who kind of turns up and digs a big hole in her backyard for reasons that I won't get into right now. And you have Judd Hirsch playing her dad, who is separated from her mother and kind of going through his later in life romance phase, I guess. And it's just wonderful. Andre Benjamin's there playing the flute. Like, there's just so much kind of to enjoy about this film and that I find special. And I can't kind of heap enough praise upon it.
Yeah, I think the funny thing that seems to have happened with Kelly Reichardt is that it's almost like her films have become like a unit of currency around like film nerds, where like let's say it'll come out that like every episode of She-Hulk costs $20 million, and people are just like, that's 20 Kelly Reichardt's. That means they could have made 180 Kelly Reichardt's for that one series. Like, yeah, you know, she seems to struggle with like funding despite like having such a passionate group of people that absolutely adore, and rightly so, adore her work.
Yeah, I mean, like, Martin Scorsese is a big fan of hers. Todd Haynes is kind of one of her oldest, like, friends and mentors. And it is kind of, I think actually he was the one that said, like, one of the problems that Kelly has is that she doesn't have a penis. Like, that's why she struggles to get her films made, which is a very Todd Haynes thing to say. Yeah, I mean, I think as well, I can understand why the sort of films she makes don't appeal to studios, because they're very quiet. You know, that she's not making Marvel movies. She's not making big dramas where lots of people shout at each other. She's kind of making these like observational portraits of what life is actually like. And I find that very special. And particularly a film like Showing Up, I find very relatable. In that kind of cringe way that we talk about, oh, it's relatable. I just found it such a kind of keenly observed portrait of like being in your kind of mid-30s and not knowing like if your life has added up to anything without being kind of, you know, really dramatic or over the top about it. I think it's such a wonderfully understated film, and I know it's based kind of on her experiences as well of like she was teaching at a college for a while, and by all accounts, like her students were not always very impressed with her teaching methods. You can kind of go away and Google that if you want to know more, but it's quite a funny story. So it is, yeah, it's you know, there's a lot to a rich text, as they say. And also, just, I've talked about this with so many people, but like, even the title of the film I find like very special, and that it's referring to this idea of who in your life kind of shows up for you, I guess, like, you know, your friends, your parents, and then that old kind of adage of like 90% of success is showing up in the first place. So I mean, I could probably sit here and talk for an hour just about this one film and all the many things I love, down to the ginger cat called Ricky, who is very badly behaved in the film, and the animatronic pigeon that features. Yeah, I just think it's really wonderful, and I believe it is getting a release here on Home Entertainment in January, so please do check it out.
Yes, stop your She-Hulk rewatch. David, more of a kind of crowd pleaser, I suppose, for you next. Who doesn't love a Fincher? And you loved The Killer.
Yes. The Killer is surprising. I mean, what it felt to me was like, so David Fincher had just come off the back of this deeply personal project called Mank, which was made from a script by his late father on essentially the kind of exploring theories about the writing of Citizen Kane. And I think it would be fair to say that it's a film that met with a mixed response, in that, you know, it was a very different film for him, in that it was kind of a historical drama filmed, you know, with his sort of quite sort of waspish sense of humor. And, you know, so I think,
I mean, I loved it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I was a big fan of it as well. But I think that certain people felt that he was engaging with that period in a strange way. And also with some of the history and the, cause you know, it's a moment in history that has been covered from many, many angles. And I think some felt that some of those angles were ignored. I digress, because we're not talking about that now. But there was, you know, when it came out, there was this news that he was doing this film called The Killer, and it was with Michael Fassbender and Tilda Swinton, and that, it's okay, kids, the real David Fincher is going to be back soon. So, you know, hold on to your bucket hats, because, you know, there's going to be some, you know, no holds barred violence, and, you know, all the stuff we love, you know, David Fincher for, the precision, you know, there's going to be, you know, it's a film about an assassin. There's going to be all this kind of precision choreography and beautiful editing, and I think it is that film. And it kind of delivers on that front, but I think the film is essentially about Michael Fassbender. He is an assassin, and you know, I think it sort of operates under many of the sort of tropes that we've seen from like assassin movies, like Gross Point Blank and Day of the Jackal and things like that. And we see him waiting, you know, we're introduced to him in an abandoned WeWork in Paris, and he's waiting to administer a hit on a VIP in the hotel across the road, and it kind of all goes wrong for him in quite a spectacular way, in that his very neat compartmentalized world just very quickly falls apart on this kind of split second hair's breadth miscalculation. And the film essentially charts his how he kind of the very, very, very roundabout way that he has to try and return to zero, essentially, and use his skill set to make sure that him and the person he loves is going to be safe. But actually, the film I love the film as a film about this very contemporary idea of like machoism and people like Andrew Tate, men's rights. There's this idea of spurting slogans and macho aphorisms and things that kind of justify you being a solo male out there against the world, no emotion. You've got to just succeed in everything you do. And his narration is essentially repetitions of these completely vapid men's rights slogans that he takes very, very seriously. And what Fincher is showing us throughout the film is just how vapid he is and how empty his kind of his worldview is. And, you know, I don't think Fincher is someone who necessarily deals with such, you know, the way that he makes films in this kind of very sort of almost technical bubble might make you think that he's not someone who's necessarily that engaged or interested in like the current political climate or social commentary that is very, very up to the minute. But I mean, if you look back to to something like Gone Girl, which, you know, that's like three different films. Like that's a kind of choose your own movie, depending on how you kind of look at it and what you want to kind of take from it. And I think the Killer is much more of a piece with a kind of Gone Girl type film, where it's kind of, it's a thriller if you want it to be, but it's also, it's this other completely different film also if you want it to be. And yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, I love that about so many of Fincher's films, where it's like you can kind of tell so much about a person given like what they thought the film was about. It does feel it's a bit of a kind of Rorschach test about it. But I know you're not a big TV person, but David, I so recommend you watch the season 5 of Fargo if you like The Killer, because there is a John Hamm character in that that is kind of a similar ilk. And, you know, there's a kind of, he kind of thinks he's this like unrelenting badass. And there's just some fabulous lines where people say to him, it's just like, you know what you're asking for is to be a baby. You want to have like, to kind of be, you know, like all of this kind of brutal badass in your mind, but you just want a load of consequence-free actions and for nobody to hold you to account. You want to be a baby.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that this film is totally about that.
But it's funny because Fincher never admits that.
Yeah, that's the stuff he doesn't talk about.
Well, when he's asked, he's like, no, I don't know who Andrew Tate is. I find that very funny. He's like, no, it's not about anything in particular. And it's like the biggest troll, or one of the biggest trolls, because I think there's quite a few, like Steven Soderbergh's a bit of a troll as well. But I think as well, I said this jokingly on Twitter, but I'm actually quite serious about it. I think that and Showing Up, great films about the gig economy and the struggles of working under capitalism, because the whole kind of underlying joke in The Killer is that the reason he is in the situation he's in is because his boss upsold the client on the package they got, and now he's been like hunted down by the insurance policy, basically, which is, you know, is quite silly. And there's lots of like there's so many kind of, I think that Adam actually talks about this in the interview from the Poor Things issue with him, the idea of like how shockingly easy some of his job is. Like there's a bit where he orders like an RFID like chip reader on Amazon, and you can do that. And Fincher said that they were just like joking about that and like how to make one. And then he said to his props guy, like, oh, I bet you can buy it on Amazon. His props guy was like, oh, you absolutely can't. That would be so bad. And then he came back 5 minutes later and he was like, oh, we live in hell, and realized that you could buy them on Amazon. So it just like stuff like that. I think, you know, I think it's such a funny film. And it was very funny seeing Fincher at Venice be like, why was no one laughing? Like, it is a funny movie. Like, I think he's right. Yeah,
oh, we were laughing.
I like it a lot. I was laughing. I think it was funny.
I love it when a film kind of explains how easy crimes are. This is where I liked Emily the Criminal, but much last year. I was just like, well, now if you know, things really go to hell, thanks to Emily the Criminal, I know how to do credit card fraud.
So much is easy if you just have no morals. That's basically what these films are about.
Can I add also just a little colour for the listener? Hannah is actually wearing her David Fincher t-shirt today, so
my Gone Girl
very
t-shirt
on brand. So
yeah, has a giant picture of Ben Affleck on the back
with your cool girl tattoo. You're really, you,
yeah,
know,
I know, walking red flag,
overselling it.
Yes.
I want to do a little shout out to Rotting in the Sun, which I think has the same kind of like fun metatextual levels in some ways of The Killer. It's also very, very funny and very, very dark in the same ways. It's sort of Sebastian Silva playing himself as a kind of depressed, washed up director who is kind of really like no longer kind of very inspired by the world around him to make art. And he encounters a sort of vacuous influencer, and then it sort of becomes a dark murder mystery. There's a huge amount of nudity, which, you know, always here for. I mean, I always love a film that is surprising. I love a tonal shift, and I absolutely adored Rotting in the Sun. And that's one of the kind of, I guess, perks of doing this podcast, because I don't know that it's necessarily one that I would have come across. It wasn't one that had a huge amount of like fanfare, but the good people of movie sent it our way. And yeah, probably maybe aside from American Fiction, the most I've laughed in the cinema this year. Wait, and maybe Hitman, but you know, that's probably going to be our end of year for next year.
Yeah, I need to rewatch Rotting in the Sun, because I remember watching it and not really getting it. But I think maybe because it was Sundance and it was like, you know, we were sat watching like however many screeners in a day, maybe it just caught me at the wrong time. Because I know that, David, you're a big fan as well.
Yeah, it's one of those films where you have to get past a certain point. You have to engage a sort of like a fairly long, slow start to get to this very finite moment where the film like starts it properly. And when it does, it's really good.
Yeah, you have to like stay with it.
Faint praise. Well, it's just, it's such a film in which the thing happens.
Yeah.
And it's like, until the thing happens, you're not quite sure in some ways why you're watching it. But because you're not quite sure, it makes when the thing happens all the better.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I'll see if I have time over Christmas. I might give it a second, you know, a second look. Because I do find sometimes, I think I watched one of his other films as well and had a similar thing where I was like, I just don't really get this. So I'll give it a go. I'll see. I'm willing to hear you both out on this one.
Well, a film where I believe you told me beforehand that this film would destroy me. I actually had to leave the screening before the Q&A because
it's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. No, yeah. Oliver Strangers, eh? I don't want to say too much because I think we'll be talking about this one again in the new year because it is technically out on like 26th of January. So I think we will be doing an episode on it, hopefully. But yeah, man, this one. Yeah, Andrew Hay, he loves making us cry. I don't think any of his films have not made me cry, in fact. I think he knows how to kind of laser focus on elements that will bring me to tears. And I remember going to see Oliver Strangers press screening with a friend of the podcast, Beth Webb. And we were sat down and we were like, oh yeah, excited to see this one. Love Andrew Scott, love Paul Mescal, love Claire Foy, love Jamie Bell. We were like, yeah, let's go. And then we came out and we were both just like faces red from how much we'd been crying. And we were like, should we go and have a pint? And we went and had a little pint and like a sit down and it kind of had to decompress because we were both just so kind of struck. So that's the preamble to say kind of what an emotional film this is. But yeah, it's based on this novel by Tachi Yamada, Strangers, which is this wonderful, it's a really good book. It's very different to this film. It's a story about a Japanese salaryman who is kind of living quite a solitary life and develops a relationship with a young woman and then starts to see the kind of ghosts of his parents. And Andrew Hay has kind of adapted it and changed it a bit and he's relocated it to London, and it focuses on a gay man, Adam, played by Andrew Scott, and he's a screenwriter who again like lives this very solitary life in this, I think it's a Croydon tower block that he's living in, which appears to be empty until he one day runs into his neighbour, who's played by Paul Mescal, doing a lovely kind of Mancunian accent, and he's called
and
Harry.
Confirming that the mullet is a choice of his, not
was
role,
it?
In like multiple. Well, when you assume it's been in like four films now.
The mullet's good look. Anyway, I mean, yeah. So he is the neighbour, very charming neighbour who imposes himself upon Adam, who is very like nervous and very kind of reticent. And over the coming weeks, Adam has a strange encounter where he goes back to his childhood home and he meets his parents as they were when he died when he was 12. They're played by Jamie Bell and Claire Foy, and over the course of the film, they kind of develop this relationship and make up for lost time, I guess. I don't want to say too much because like a lot of people won't have seen it yet, and there's so much that happens in this film, and it kind of like midway through I started crying and didn't really stop. I think it's just such a beautiful articulation of grief and what happens when someone passes away, but you still kind of have all that like love inside of you that you don't know what to do with. And this is something that in the latest issue, Andrew Hay was talking about, you know, this is something he wanted to explore, this idea of what do we do with all the love that we can no longer pour into a person? And, you know, what does that do to us? How does that manifest? And I just think it's such a sad film, but has this like weird kind of hopefulness to it as well. And I think there's a real like quartet of incredible performances, like some of the best of the year here, particularly Claire Foy. Actually, I should give a special shout out to, because I think she's really good in this. And I'm not like, I didn't watch The Crown. I'm not really that, I actively dislike Unsane. So I'm not really a Claire Foy person, but I think she's really wonderful in this. And of course, Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal are just kind of next level. And yeah, it feels like very special. still emotional, but not kind of cloying or not kind of manipulative film. I think it's just honest, you know, honest about so many things, honest about, you know, about death, about queerness, particularly in England, particularly under Thatcher and kind of beyond. And I think it just understands something about how difficult it is to just exist as a single person in the world who kind of feels disconnected from everyone around them. And I can't kind of sing its praises enough. I think it's one of the year's best films, and I think Andrew Hay is just such an incredibly talented filmmaker.
Yeah, it's strange for a film that is that kind of emotionally devastating to not feel that you were manipulated into those feelings at all. A film that I didn't like at all this year was one called Origin. And, like, that to me was such a sort of brazen attempt to, like, punch you in the heart. And, like, this is... It earns it, I suppose. I mean, I did cry at Origin because it's almost like jump scare. Like, that, you know, like, lizard brain kicks in. And I was just like, oh, God, yeah, that was a terribly sad thing that happened. But this is just... I almost, like, haven't stopped thinking about it. And it's been weeks since I watched it. And, yeah, no, I've been a big fan of Claire Foy's for ages, ever since she made an excellent TV series about Israel and Palestine that I feel couldn't be made nowadays, called The Promise. Yeah, I'm very glad she's getting these meaty roles, and I hope that she gets some award attention for this, because I think it's a really, really stunning performance.
Yeah, and a difficult one to, like, play the mother of a full-grown man, but play that as though you are a young woman. Like, it's kind of tricky, you know. She's not playing, like, the mother of an adult. She's playing the mother of a 12-year-old, but the 12-year-old is Andrew Scott. And, I think there's one scene where they're kind of talking about, he basically comes out to her, and I just think it's such a masterclass in restraint and, yeah, honesty. It sounds kind of trite, but I do think it earns all its emotional beats, this film. And I have friends who don't like it and kind of do think it is cloying somehow, but it's just not my read on it at all. And I also, like, I mean, I believe I've mentioned on this podcast before that I'm, like, a massive cinema crier. Like, I cry so much in the cinema. And I felt very vindicated talking to Andrew Hay, because he was like, oh yeah, me too. Now I'm constantly crying. I think there's something really nice about a cry. And so it felt quite vindicating to, you know, have a filmmaker who was like, well, you know, I don't go out of my way to make people cry, but if they do cry, I'm not sad about that, I'm right there with you. And he said when he was editing it, he was crying a lot, like with his editor Jonathan Alberts. And I was like, oh, okay, well, even if the guy who, like, wrote it and filmed it is still emotionally impacted by it, then, you know, clearly it's something special. But yeah, I think it's really wonderful, and some great needle drops as well, a great British pop music in this film.
Beautiful film, really strongly recommend it. I really strongly recommend your interview, because I love it when a sort of interviewer and interviewee seem to kind of so deeply connect, and I really got that from your piece.
Yeah, we'll be putting that online in January as well. I think we've actually got a longer version to go online, because we had a good chat. Yeah, he's a really generous conversationalist, as well as, like, an incredibly talented filmmaker. He, watching his films, I think I always thought it could kind of go either way speaking to him, because they're so serious in a lot of ways, his films. But no, he's delightful in real life. Very honest, very open, very generous, and really keen to, like, if you have an emotional response to his film, he's kind of keen to dig into that. So yeah, definitely, please, if you're at all interested, check out the film in January. It's a nice one, I think, for those kind of cold, sad end of January vibes. It's a cathartic one, I think.
Yeah, I would add to the list as one of my picks Saint-Omer, which I do believe has sort of in some ways been, like, underserved, because it came out so early in the year, and for a lot of people it was seemed to be a 2022 film, and for some people it seemed to be a 2023 film. But it was on, you know, Little White Lies, it's considered a this year film. Also, I think a film that would pair really nicely with All of Us Strangers, in that, like, it's looking at parenthood, it's looking at, like, the complexity of and the difficulty of just living in the world, at loneliness, and I think it's very striking without ever spilling into melodrama. Not that, like, melodrama is an issue, it can be employed beautifully as, you know, something like May, December, but I think Saint-Omer, Alice Diop, has got such a kind of crisp and subtle take on what is kind of one of the most awful tragedies imaginable. And it's
gorgeous. And there was something that I saw the other day where somebody said that, like, all these French courtroom films, like, you know, your Saint-Omer's and your Anatomy of a Fall, like, is a lot of it just down to, like, the wood in these courtrooms? Like,
they got some nice courtrooms.
they got some beautiful joinery going on. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you about Saint-Omer. Absolutely incredible film. Again, made me cry, but very earned crying as well. Like, just such a beautifully judged film about such an incredibly difficult subject to broach, and manages to delve into the kind of ethics of documentary whilst it's there. Like, it's what Alice Diop does with this film is just astounding. And I do think it has gone a bit under the radar for the end of year lists because it technically fell into that strange between area for a lot of places.
Amazing film also about how you can make a film in a single room. Like, the way it's shot is really, really clever and very subtle. So yeah, amazing. I agree, amazing film. But yeah, probably on my mind last year more than it was this year.
Well, not to go full conspiracy theory nut, but when it came to the Sight and Sound thing, I believe it did rank the second best film of 2022 and then the 10th of 2023, because, you know, they judge these things as kind of like when you've seen them. I counted the votes, and it got more than, if you total those, it got more than After Sun last year and more than Killers of the Flower Moon this year. So I think technically it did top.
But did you check to see if anyone voted for it twice?
I didn't. I just kind of trusted in the ethics.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I do think there'll be films, obviously, that come out this year. They'll come out in February, March this year that we've really loved, and they will kind of maybe rank a little bit lower than they necessarily should next year. It's just part of the UK and our crazy release schedule. It's really irritating. That's why we're here. We're here to make sure people actually go and see these films.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, David, your next one, which is on the list, is Trenk-Lauren. I haven't seen this one. Tell me all about it.
Sorry, Trenk-Lauren.
Trenk-Lauren.
So, weird. Trenk-Lauren. This is probably, for me, hopefully not sounding too sort of edgelordy, but this was probably my favourite film I saw this year. It actually was in Venice in 22, and then it was at a couple more festivals in the interim. I caught it in Rotterdam in January, and I've since watched it again. And then it came out here in November, might have been early December, but it's currently out here in the UK now on select screens. I think Curzon have it on Curzon Home as well, so it is available to view like now. Yeah, it's this incredible film by Argentinian filmmaker called Laura Citarella, who is part of this collective called El Pampero Cine, who are a kind of independent production outfit/collective who essentially do this thing where one person will direct, then another person will produce, and another person will write, and then some of them will perform in the films as well. And then for the next film, they'll all switch around. So the director will then produce, and the producer will direct, and the write, you know, and they'll still all kind of star in it as well. So it's kind of like everyone has their turn to make their film. And the big film they're probably known for is called La Flore, which was a kind of 10-hour epic that I think played at the ICA. I think it opened at the ICA brief, like had a couple of screenings there. It's kind of really hard to see now for some reason. Like there's Blu-rays of it are very hard to come by. But that was by a director called Mariano Lianas, and this new one is not 10 hours, but it's 4 hours, and it's a sort of 4-hour film. Where, you know, we were sort of talking about Rotting in the Sun earlier, where you kind of have to watch it to a point until it kind of, there's a drop. You know, it's a bit like the kind of Psycho thing where the film just pivots at a moment in the middle, and you kind of have to get to that point for it to sort of hit you. And Tranquil Alpine is a film that does that, but after like 2 hours. So like you have 2 hours, and then there is a kind of, you know, it's not even a twist. It's a kind of a change in direction. And then you've got like another film that is kind of quite different in tone, but very, very sort of justified overall as a kind of piece about, essentially it's a piece about a woman who is doing a thing. And then suddenly she decides she wants to do another thing. And it's a film about kind of being empowered to change your mind and how women should feel empowered to break out of like capitalist power structures, professional needs to actually do what they think is like, to do what they want to do. And it follows this character who is, so Tranquil Alpine is a little kind of community, like a area city in like the western portion of Argentina. And the film is very, I think subtly, but in quite a pronounced way, inspired by Twin Peaks, because it's very much about kind of the place and the sort of strange happenings that are going on there and the various characters. And it's all told in flashbacks. So you have, it opens with this, the announcement, there's a woman missing. Her name's Laura. And turns out that her job is, she works for the local radio station where she has a show where she talks about revolutionary women. Like her slot is every week she introduced their listeners to a revolutionary woman. And she's also a kind of land surveyor, but also she does think she spends a lot of time in the library researching these women. And there's a guy who's fallen in love with her and he's helping her with her research, and he is kind of telling the story about her disappearance and essentially this mystery that she discovered and sort of let him into, where she was doing research in the library and found, at complete random, discovered a love letter that had been kind of concealed between two pages of a book. And it was a kind of love letter that was clearly part of a wider correspondence. And so she kind of, the first 2 hours of the film is about her obsessive sort of delve down the rabbit hole to try and piece together this strange correspondence that was happening between two people who obviously weren't allowed to be together but were communicating in this kind of very charming secret way. And it is kind of initially about her obsession, but then at the point where you think she's going to be completely consumed and make this big discovery, her attention is just drawn off somewhere else for a completely different reason. And this other sort of in thing that she does is more, it's more of a kind of like, I've mentioned Twin Peaks, but also like The X-Files would probably be a good reference point for the sort of second part of the film, because it kind of, there's a strange sort of paranormal bent to it as well. But it's just a beautifully made, detailed film that is dealing with these huge ideas. And it's not afraid to sort of go quite kind of emotional and melodramatic as well. And the writing is just, it's kind of very novelistic, and there's stories nestled in stories and perspectives and viewpoints. And, you know, there are many plates spinning about like, whose flashback is this? And should we believe them? And is it, you know, is what we're seeing, truth or reality? So there's just a lot going on in it. That makes it sound like a very difficult watch, but it's very much not that. Laura Citarella is an incredible filmmaker who just, you know, almost like kind of that Christopher Nolan type thing where he's very good at kind of doing the sort of nesting dolls narratives, but making them very sort of approachable. And she can kind of do that as well with this. So yeah, I just felt really, I mean, I guess like a bit like All of Us Strangers, I just, at the end, the sort of end of this film, I kind of felt very emotionally overwhelmed. But like, it's got that kind of intense melancholy to it as well, if you really go with it. But yeah, I thought it was an incredible achievement and just one of my personal, like, this is why we go to the movies moments of 2023.
I am not at all averse to a very, very long film, but I do think I do occasionally need a bit of a endorsement before I get myself to, what is it, like 4 hours? But now I've got that. This is going to be something I'm definitely going to seek out. That sounds incredible. Completely changing tone. Got more of a sort of like accessible crowd pleaser, I suppose.
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, our big, most populous film so far has been The Killer, so we did need something.
I thought we needed something light because I was looking at the films we'd chosen and then I was like, man, maybe something a bit different. And now I just feel like a child. But this was one of my surprises of the year because I kind of, when it was announced, I was like, oh, I don't care. And then I saw it and it was delightful, which is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, which is, yes, another reboot of the classic franchise.
That's what we need.
Just what we need. That's exactly what I thought when it was announced. And it's actually like very, very charming. It's directed by Jeff Rowe and co-directed by Kyla Spears. I'm sure if you're an animation person, these names will mean something. I will watch animated films, but I'm not massively, you know, some people are really into that. I'm not, sorry, you know, I'm getting angry letters from people, but yeah, I don't know, I'm just not normally super into it, but I did give this a chance because I'd heard it was very good, and I like Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, and they kind of did the screenplay for it, and it's really fun. What can I say? It's this kind of, you know, how would I describe the style of it? It's kind of a little bit hand-drawn in style, but it's still like 3D animation. It feels very kind of, I guess, naive, the style of the kind of drawing, but very, very charming. It's kind of that same approach, I guess, they've taken with the new Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse films, where they've tried to make it look kind of comic booky, and it actually like really works here. It's very charming, and it's, you know, it's just the story of how the turtles were found by Master Splinter in the sewers, and them kind of growing up being taught by Master Splinter, and then, you know, being teenagers and wanting to go out into the world where they meet all these other mutants, and they have to kind of decide if they want to side with the mutants or try and kind of integrate into society, which is difficult because all the humans are terrified of them. But yeah, it's very, very funny. It's charming. I think they did something really smart, which is actually cast teenagers to play the turtles. So they're all kind of around the right age, you know, between, I think, 14 and 18 when they were doing these voice recordings. And I think it just gives like the kind of chemistry, like a bit of a boost, because, you know, when they're all kind of bickering and talking, it feels like you're listening to a bunch of kids, and it's very funny. They're kind of, you know, arguing about, like, one of them's really into anime and like BTS, and all the others like make fun of him for it, and yeah, there's just lots of little moments like that which are really sweet. And I think it is one of the kind of best assembled casts of the year. We've got Ayo Adibiri playing April O'Neil, and she's great. I think she's an incredible voice actor anyway, as well as been a great live action actor. And then Ice Cube playing this horrible fly mutant called Superfly, and he has all these little minions, one of which is Paul Rudd playing this skateboarding gecko called Mondo Gecko. It's just really, really silly and fun, and I was amazed at how much I actually enjoyed it, because I'm not like a turtle person. I've seen most of the recent-ish reboots, the Michael Bay ones, I've seen those and they're really, really bad. So, you know, my expectations were on the floor for this one, and then I was like so charmed. Jackie Chan plays Master Splinter. He's really good in it. Yeah, I could just sit here and be like, yes, here are all the little things in this film that I loved, because it's just kind of, you know, 90 minutes, very entertaining, knows what it is, doesn't try to kind of overcomplicate things, but inserts enough like personality that it doesn't just feel like, you know, you're kind of going through the motions. Very, very fun film. Whether or not you're kind of into animation or not, I think there's a lot there. And, you know, at Christmas, it's nice, isn't it, to have something that everyone can kind of sit down and watch together. And this is one of those.
My 5-year-old daughter loved it.
See?
Yeah. She was really big into
it's
it.
It's cute. It's really and, sweet. It's a sweet
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, we were in CEX the other day and she picked up the Blu-ray and said, "Can I have this? I love this movie."
Aww.
And I said, "No, it's £8."
Oh, okay. Yeah. My husband took my kids without me, so I haven't seen it, but they have assured me that they are more than willing to rewatch it, and I'm going to rewatch it hopefully around Christmas with my brother as well, who was obsessed with the Turtles growing up. I kind of grew up where we had like the live action ones. Oh my God, there is an amazing line in the original where Shredder tries to get them to, like, he basically makes Bebop and Rocksteady, but he doesn't realize that he's done it with infants. they kind of emerge, and then, like, he turns to the camera and screams, like, "They're babies!"
That's quite funny.
Line of cinema, possibly ever.
In this one, Bebop
does this film and, have that?
It has Bebop and Rocksteady. They're played by Seth Rogen and John Cena.
Are they babies?
Well, I don't think they're babies, but you see the baby turtles and they're very, very cute. And I have to say, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross did the score for this, which is crazy. Like, you know,
those guys are booked and busy.
They are booked and busy. They will take the gig. If you've got the money, they've got the time. There's actually like, there's just so many little kind of asides and like one liners in it that I do find it. Like, there's a bit where one of the turtles, the one who's obsessed with anime, I can't tell them apart. I know they have like different colors, but I can't tell them apart. Anyway, the one that's obsessed with like,
what color is he? I'll tell you.
I think he's blue.
Leonardo.
Okay, maybe it isn't Leonardo.
Oh no, that sounds more like a Donatello vibe.
I think it might be Michelangelo. I don't. Anyway,
so Michelangelo is the kind of bro-y one. Raphael is this kind of sarcastic one. Leonardo is the sort of moral compass, and Donatello is the nerd.
Well, whichever one the nerd is.
At least that's the classic lore.
Right, okay, so whichever one the nerd is he purple, maybe that's why I'm getting it confused.
Yeah,
okay,
Donatello's purple.
Okay, so anyway, he's obsessed with anime and he's like sad, and so the others are singing like BTS, like Dynamite by BTS, to like cheer him up, but like very softly, and he just says like through his tears, "You guys don't even know the lyrics." And it's just like such like a little teenager thing that you would say, like they're doing a nice thing, you're like, "You don't even know the song," like it's, yeah, there's so many bits like that which I just found delightful. And then in the, even like the credits are really funny, like you look through like the name list, there's like people credited as like man who thought giant rat was actually a big cat but it was in fact a giant rat, like stuff like that. It's just like it's that kind of like silliness that you want from a kid's movie, but with intent, rather than it just being like, haha, let's do like fart jokes. It's actually, yeah, kind of creatively silly in a way that I really enjoyed. I might watch it again at Christmas. I really think it's a delightful film.
I am completely sold. That sounds wonderful. I would also just like to shout out, in terms of like films that I did not expect to be great and really were, Evil Dead Rise, which is also on the Little White Lies list. Like another sort of, could have just been like a naked IP grab. That was another one that I cried. And it was just gnarly and great. And, you know, if anything, this year does feel like a bit like there's sort of change in the air. You know, a lot of the tentpole films have not been doing as well. It feels like some rather kind of serious stuff, some animation, some, you know, 3.5-hour biopics have been like doing incredibly at the box office. And like, it feels like maybe Evil Dead Rise also kind of marks a change away from the sort of self-serious, quote-unquote, elevated horror into something a little bit more proud to be a horror film. It feels like half of these horror films have been like slightly embarrassed by being in the genre.
Yeah, it's very violent, which I was quite surprised by. I mean, I know it's an Evil Dead film, but like, yeah, I am sadly one of those horror fans that really likes like the kind of hyper violent films. and that and like Saw 10, I was like, yes, you're giving me what it should be from these kind of like schlocky franchises. Like you want that kind of like recoil a bit from the screen factor, and stuff like Megan and Barbarian, which I enjoy both of those films, but they're kind of like half like a teenage movie, half like an adult. They don't really know what they are, even though I enjoyed them. Whereas Evil Dead Rise, they were like, yep, you want an Evil Dead movie, we're going to kind of go balls to the wall, just like 90. So yeah, it's like 90 minutes as well. Yeah, just like splatter, like, again, like really kind of gross things happening. And yeah, it's good fun, good time.
Yeah, I have to say one of the worst takes that I've seen online was somebody complaining about how Evil Dead Rise like attacks queer characters and therefore is like problematic, and it's just like, you know, it's the Evil Dead, it doesn't discriminate.
It's equality.
Yeah. No, I don't think
say
anyone...
what you want about the Evil Dead.
that demon will possess anyone.
Do you guys want to maybe talk about what the top pick is for the year for Little White Lies? Something that we touched on not long ago on the podcast, and you had an incredible interview, Hannah, but May, December, number one with a bullet.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll hand over to David to say more, because obviously I did do the podcast about it. But yeah, I mean, this was the one we all very easily agreed on as being like our favourite of the year.
Yeah, it was the consensus pick. So Todd Haynes also was the victor of our 2015 poll of films of the year, in that he won with his film Carol. And so this is his second time at the top to have silverware from Little White Lies for one of his movies. Yeah, it's a very, like, you know, in fact, I was actually on a call with a friend yesterday who hadn't seen it, and was saying and was asking, should I see it? And I was like, well, definitely you should see it. And he was like, but it, you know, what is it? And I was like, interesting. And it's like, this is someone who's seen lots of old films, and we actually recently last year we were in Locarno together, and we went to see a load of old Douglas Sirk films. So we were kind of talking about them, and I sort of said, well, like, a lot of people sort of dismiss Douglas Sirk films as just being kind of schmaltzy melodrama, because that's kind of almost the impression you have of them, even if you haven't seen them, because that's how Douglas Sirk is pegged, and that's how his films look and feel, and that's the actors he has in the films, and you kind of peg it a certain way. But if you actually watch the movies, they're really strange and weird, and you know that there's lots of, you know, really really radical and weird things happening in them, and they're not these kind of like show your mama melodramas at all. They are something altogether different. And Haynes already made Far From Heaven, which was his kind of homage to Sirk, and this I think is like May December almost sort of fits in that mold as well, of being, it's a film that takes some of the kind of architecture of melodrama, but is doing something very very kind of weird and almost quite transgressive with it. The setup is, you have Julianne Moore as this woman, and it transpires that she is in a relationship with a much younger guy, played by Charles Melton, and they seem to be living this very idyllic suburban life, albeit one where they seem to be randomly getting sent dog turds in the post. But then it's not a kind of like, you know, a shocker film about a intergenerational relationship, and it's not necessarily about grooming as well. It actually explores this situation from a completely different angle via Natalie Portman's actor, who is kind of joining them and living with them for a bit and immersing herself in their world, while she researches the role of Julianne Moore's character, which is being made into what turns out to be looks like a fairly crummy TV movie, but one which Portman's character is taking very, very seriously. And on one hand, it brings out all these really, really kind of fascinating questions about grooming and about intergenerational relationships and older women. And it goes on a very kind of quite melancholy existential bent about these people kind of in this moment where these people are kind of forced to think about themselves and, you know, tell this actor their thoughts, their feelings, their motivations, that it's actually dawning on them what has actually happened to them and this, you know, how they have like reached the system, the situation they're in. But the film is also very much about the kind of ethics of representation. And Portman, it's probably, maybe you can give some other examples, but I can't think of a better performance by her off the top of my head. One that is not just so nuanced, but she is so in on the joke and what her character represents, and has got such a deep knowledge of what Haynes is trying to do with this film. And I think, and so, I mean, you know, you expect Julianne Moore to be on the level already, but like, The fact that we've got two actors doing it, and three in Charles Melton as well, who just really understands the nuances of this story. Maybe it might sound in description to be possibly a sort of slightly unassuming film of the year, but I think for us it's a film that, like, probably for me personally has been one I've thought about a lot. And yeah, it's one I hope that kind of does well, lives on, becomes more front and center than it currently is in the award season debates. I mean, it's always a film that was going to sort of ruffle feathers in terms of the fact that it looks at grooming in a very kind of empathetic and non-judgmental way. So, you know, I think you're always going to have like pearl clutches going a bit mad. So yeah, no tech, you know, he's a master, and after the films he made between Carol and now were maybe sort of not quite up to his, you know, they were decent but not quite up to his very, very high standard, but this is like back to the best.
Yeah, this is like, it's one I've not stopped thinking about. And even like reading the screenplay, Sammy Birch, this is her first, like, I don't know if it was her first one she'd written, but certainly this is her first like screenplay that's made it to the screen. And she just has come out like fully formed. Like, it is such an intelligent and layered script, and so much of the performances are tied to that. It's, you know, it's not a case where it's like, oh yeah, you can see that they've really had to, you know, kind of work. There are some writers who don't, it's not on the page, it's kind of, you know, it's all in the performance, it's all in the building around that. But this is like, it's that perfect storm of having Todd Haynes, who is such a master of directing actors, and then having this incredible script, and then three actors who just completely understood who their characters were and how they worked together as this little kind of triangle. And yeah, it's marvelous. I'm very excited to see what my mom makes of it, because in theory it sounds up her street. In reality, we will see how it goes down at Christmas. But yeah, it's great.
Makes me all the more excited for Sammy Birch's next project, which, you know, Coyote versus Acme, which nearly got shelved by Warner Brothers. But I think maybe we will be able to see in 2024.
I hope so.
Before I let you go, anything that you've seen that you think that's coming out and, you know, is too late for this year's list, but is going to be out in 2024? Do you think that's likely to be on the end of year list when we do this in a year's time?
I want to give a shout out again. We'll probably end up doing this one on the podcast in the new year, but I want to shout out The Iron Claw, which is Sean Durkin's new film about the Von Erich wrestling dynasty. I don't know how many listeners will be familiar with the Von Erichs. I certainly wasn't until I heard about this film coming out, but they were a wrestling kind of family, generations of men who were in wrestling in the 70s and 80s, and they were kind of afflicted by a lot of tragedy, some avoidable, some not, and this film kind of brings that to life with Zac Efron and Harris Dickinson, who we love and support on this podcast, and Jeremy Allen White and Holt McAnally, I think is how you pronounce it, from Mindhunter, of course. Again, absolutely devastating film. I either recommend like the kind of sweetest, happiest films, or like the emotionally devastating ones. There's no in between, apparently. But yeah, it's very good. It's got that balance of like kind of high melodrama, but like deep kind of sadness. And I think it's a really interesting take on kind of American pop culture and American patriarchy, American dads in general. I think, you know, there's this breed of kind of stoic manifest destiny that the patriarch of this family has, that really like sets the course for quite a lot of tragedy in their family. And yeah, it's very, very good. I highly recommend it. And Zac Efron finally getting like a good role after quite a lot of years of been stuck in things beneath his talents. Yeah, he's very good in the film, and yeah, it's great. Highly recommend.
He's phenomenal in it. I watched it the first time knowing absolutely nothing about it. I didn't even know that it was a true story. And then I read everything that the internet had on this family, watched it again, works in both kind of levels of knowledge. I would like to shout out a film from Sudan called Goodbye Julia, which I believe is getting distribution in the new year, set during the 2011 revolution, and then also during an assassination of a figure from South Sudan called Jiang Garang. It's a really, really stunning film. It's from, it's being produced by the man who directed You Will Die at 20, Amjad Abuela, who I think is a really, really striking talent. And yeah, things aren't going great in Sudan at the moment, but we have some very talented filmmakers at least doing some positive things. David, anything that you'd like to kind of have people look forward to for 2024?
Yeah, I'm going to shout out a film called Orlando, My Political Biography by Paul B. Preciado. I'm not sure how to pronounce that name. It's Preciado or Preciado. But Paul B. Preciado is a trans academic turned filmmaker who has made this incredible ethereal documentary. And it's essentially taking Virginia Woolf's Orlando, which, you know, we know Sally Potter made this incredible film out of, about a man who changes into, quite suddenly changes into a woman. And it's a kind of, it's probably more an essay film than documentary, but it has lots of trans subjects talking about their lives and also intoning passages from Orlando, dressed in a kind of Orlando ruff. And it is kind of drawing these very subtle parallels between the kind of literary foresightedness of Virginia Woolf and these very mundane details of living life as trans and going through like the actual process of going through transition and the choices that you make and how those decisions come about and the implications as well. And it's just a very beautiful and I just found it very beautiful, moving, insightful, radical film that kind of, you know, is also very, is educational in a way that is, but also, you know, has humor in it and just moments where you just want to kind of cry, not at kind of, you know, moments of horror and sadness, but actually at the beauty of self-actualization, of the stories of self-actualization. And yeah, I think it's coming out in March next year, and it's, yeah, really bowled me over.
Yeah. Yeah. Another one that, I kind of heard about on the festival circuit and only heard very good things about, but I suppose only so many hours in the day, and you know, kind of nice to save yourself a treat for the new year. Thank you both very, very much. The new issue is out with Poor Things, one of the most exciting things that is also happening in 2024. And yeah, we hope to have you listening to the pod next year as well, and all of the exciting films and exciting guests and interviews that we will have coming up. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon or tweet us at LWLies. Have a very, very Merry Christmas, and thank you very much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Sankus.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.